My name is Dr. Sharon Stoll, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Neurology at Yale School of Medicine. I also specialize in multiple sclerosis and neuroimmunology.
Why, by the way, are you interested in MS?
When I first entered the workforce as a neurologist, one of the things that was so exciting at the time was the creation of a lot of different disease-modifying therapies, so the medications we use to treat multiple sclerosis. Before 2010, there were mostly only injectable medications that weren't really as effective as the medications we have now. And when I was in residency during my training, the oral disease-modifying therapies were introduced. General neurologists that usually treated the disease didn't really have the time to do another training because the complexity of all of these new medications were so vast. And I saw an opportunity not only to really take care of this subset of people, but be that expert.
Do we know why somebody develops MS, or is that the $64,000 question?
There's a lot of different reasons why somebody can develop multiple sclerosis. Something that's been recently in the news that a lot of MS physicians were already aware of is Epstein-Barr virus exposure. And we're not sure at what point that trigger can occur, but there have been studies that show that 100% of the pediatric multiple sclerosis population is positive for Epstein-Barr virus, better known as mono, so the kissing disease. I don't know if it's still called that, but that definitely seems to be a trigger. However, we know that many people in the United States have positive Epstein-Barr virus, or EBV, and not as many people have multiple sclerosis. So it's definitely not the only factor. Another factor is genetics. There's definitely a genetic predisposition. And not necessarily that somebody in your family had multiple sclerosis, but usually there's an autoimmune history. So maybe a first cousin or sibling or aunt or parents with rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or thyroid disease. And then there's also an environmental component. So vitamin D deficiency is also well established. So it's definitely multifactorial.
Are researchers trying also to get at the disease from the white blood cell phase where they start doing their dirty work?
Yeah, most of the newer MS medication does exactly that. It starts at in the periphery, which is the body, and limits that immune process because most of the disease is definitely in that white blood cell phase, as you mentioned, where the cells think your myelin or the protective coat around that axon, that nerve cell, is a bacteria or a virus, and it just starts attacking it. So in our field, we learned, well, we can attack them first.
Is there any way also of protecting that sheath?
That's a great question. So some of the earlier medications, there's one that actually helps protect that blood-brain barrier or keep bad things out or keep that immune system out. There's another one that one of the earlier MS medications that is kind of like a decoy. So it looks like myelin so that your cells can attack it. Oh. Instead of attacking your white blood cell or your myelin sheath first, but that one isn't as effective.
What are the symptoms that you're seeing with MS when there's an onset of MS?
It's funny because when I first started over 10 years ago, I would say the first set of symptoms that somebody typically has is usually not the set of symptoms that brings them to a neurologist. And over 10 years later, that is still very much the case. So I'm happy people like you are bringing more attention to this so that if somebody does have these symptoms, they know kind of who to go to or to be that advocate for themselves. Like, no, I think I need to see a neurologist sooner rather than later. And that first set of symptoms is numbness and tingling, usually in an arm or a leg on one side of the body, or it could be on the arm and a leg on that same side. But many times people will go to their primary care physician or provider and their provider will say, oh, you know, maybe you slept on it funny, maybe you exercised in a different way and it's a pinched nerve. And if it doesn't start getting better in a few weeks, then come back and we'll do some imaging or I'll send in a referral. And typically it gets better in a few weeks. So that patient is never referred to us. But that's not what only happens with a pinched nerve or a herniated disc. It also happens with transverse myelitis, which is that attack in the spinal cord.
And also vision is often affected.
Yes. So that's usually the symptom that does bring somebody in to see us. So I'm glad you brought that up. It's called optic neuritis. Mm. And sometimes optic neuritis is the first set of symptoms. And then patients come are referred to the neurologist. And sometimes it's that transverse myelitis that happens first. So the symptom with optic neuritis, so people listening don't think that, oh, I have blurred vision, I need to go see a neurologist right away because I might have multiple sclerosis. It's very, very specific in that it's one eye, not both eyes. A lot of people will know blurred vision in both eyes as we get older. But this is very, very much a one-eye issue. And it's not just blurred vision, but it's also pain with eye movement. So if somebody looks to the right, looks to the left, their eye socket will hurt, almost like a migraine on that side of the head. But with that blurred vision, that vision looking staticky or going gray.
And vertigo is often mentioned as one symptom, but wow, what you talk about with the eye, that seems like that could cause vertigo as well.
Yeah, so vertigo, that's something that as a neurologist, I get to kind of use my basic neuro skills. And vertigo is room spinning. For anybody that has had vertigo, myself included, it's not just feeling dizzy or feeling off balance or woozy or lightheaded, because a lot of people will call all of those symptoms vertigo, and it's not. So vertigo, which is the room is spinning around, people are very nauseous, sometimes they're vomiting also, you barely stand up, you have to hold on to something because the room is spinning. That is actually not related to multiple sclerosis. That is usually a loosened crystal in the ear that moves around and makes you feel like you're on a roller coaster. So vertigo in itself is more of a ENT or ear, nose, and throat issue and not neurologic, but that it's not in the central nervous system, in the brain, okay. But in the periphery, in the inner ear. Those symptoms, vertigo, we refer to it as benign paroxysmal or proximal paroxysmal vertigo, so BPPV, and usually lasts a few minutes and then will subside. The MS type vertigo, which actually isn't vertigo, is more dizziness. That is more mild, and it actually is from a lesion or a spot in the part of the brain that is affected by alcoholism or when you're drunk, called the cerebellum. So a lot of people with a lesion or a white spot in that area will come in and they'll say, yeah, my friends or my family asks me if I'm drunk and that's how I feel. I feel drunk, like I can't walk in a straight line. I feel like I'm falling over, like I'm tipsy, but I'm not. I promise, doctor, I didn't have any alcohol. And it's more that dizziness or sense of imbalance, what happens with multiple sclerosis as well as other neurologic diseases.
Different people talk differently about their symptoms, and it seems that, is it different forms of MS that they're talking about, or does MS affect different people differently?
That's a great point that you make. It definitely affects different people differently, but the three things that you mentioned are three of the biggest main symptoms or relapses that are seen. There is a lot of similarities, but the other symptoms like cognitive difficulty, word-finding difficulty, severe fatigue, spasticity, those symptoms usually come later on, but it can also happen at the beginning of the disease. And those are symptoms that will vary from person to person. Some people will say, oh yeah, I have none of those symptoms. And other people will have a lot of those symptoms and not much of the other stuff. But there are different types of multiple sclerosis. Mm-hmm. So relapsing remitting, which is kind of what happens in the beginning of the disease, the first 15 years or so, where somebody will have a brand new set of symptoms, those symptoms will go away. And then another set of brand new symptoms will occur maybe a year or two later. And then in between, people do relatively well. The symptoms will go away, they feel normal, nothing much is going on. And then there's also a version that is called primary progressive. And that primary progressive happens in about 15% of MS individuals. And the primary progressive is when symptoms occur, but much more slowly. So it might be something that is not noticed right away. It might take a year, even 2 years, before somebody reaches out to a neurologist because they think, oh, well, maybe it is a bad knee or a bad back that's causing me to fall more, or that's causing my foot not to do what I'm telling it to do. And those symptoms will just get worse with time. They won't get better. And those are the two main different types of multiple sclerosis that we see.
A friend of mine, she's developed stabbing pain and burning in her feet. And also her toes are starting to curl, like hammer toes, I guess you would call them.
So that's called neuropathy or neuropathic pain. And that's when the signals from the brain down to the toes or the fingertips aren't firing properly. So the way I look at it as it's not a new lesion or a new relapse or a new spot in that spinal cord, but it's what happens over time. So if you think of it as a wire, like a computer charger, and you might have a cut in that plastic coat or that rubber coat around the charger. And when you hold it a certain way, it's fine and the computer charges perfectly. But over time, the more that charger moves around, the more you plug it in, the more you use it, the more you're finding yourself having to adjust it so that it charges the computer. And eventually, you might even see sparks flying in that area, that now that cut that's become bigger and bigger. And the signal just does not get from the outlet to the computer the way it should. It slows down. And that's kind of how I look at the electrical system over time, that even though it's not from a new relapse or a new lesion, it's from degeneration or that electrical sensation with time. And that symptom that your friend is noticing is something that unfortunately happens years after, and it makes it very, very hard for people to sleep at night because those symptoms are much more frequent at bedtime. And the good news is it can be treated with medication that's different than the MS medication, that the disease-modifying therapy. It's what we would call symptomatic medication, so something to take to dampen down that nerve signal. And it's effective, those meds, but one of the issues is we still don't have medications to repair that damage, you know, like an Apple store. Still can't take our spinal cords to an Apple store to get it fixed up.
What kind of medication is that? What kind should be asked for?
The three that I like to use, one is called Lyrica or pregabalin, Neurontin or gabapentin, and Cymbalta. So those are the three, my three go-tos, but unfortunately, depending on insurance company, some may be preferred over others. And then the other thing that happens over time is spasms. So painful Charlie horse. We all think of it as cramping in the calf. It happens with multiple sclerosis patients much more frequently, also making it very, very hard to sleep at night. And it can be debilitating. And medications for the spasms are baclofen or Flexeril or Scalastin. So medications that basically help turn that switch off. So with a spasm, the muscle cramps and tightens up. So what you were saying before, that hammer toe, that, you know, the toes are curling. So that's what happens when the muscles are unable to shut off. And so the medications I mentioned, the baclofen and Flexeril, those medications shut it off. But one of the main side effects is it also makes you tired. But the good news is that those spasms typically happen at bedtime. So it's two birds, one stone. I tell my patients, take it 20 minutes before getting into bed. It'll prevent the spasms and help you fall asleep at night.
That's good. It seems that there are many new treatments coming out for MS. Why is that?
Yeah, very, very exciting. I mean, for 20 years, we didn't really have any new treatments. And then kind of like all of these pharmaceutical companies figured out a similar thing at a similar time. So a lot of the clinical trials went into development around the same time. And it was a question of which one came to the market first. So now we have all of these amazing therapies, and it's just a really exciting time to be in the field. But all of the medications that people are seeing on TV, at least the ones that I'm familiar with, they're great therapies. And I would definitely recommend talking to your physician about them if you have any questions. And it might not be the best medication for you, but that's what the MS neurologist is for, to help guide through that process.
You do clinical trials also at Yale. How do people get involved in clinical trials?
Yeah, we do. We do a lot of clinical trials at Yale. And on our website, we actually talk about the different trials that we have available. And for those not living in the Connecticut area, there's a NIH website that you can actually look at the disease that you have and all the clinical trials that are happening around the country. But if you schedule an appointment or even ask to speak to somebody, we can walk you through that process. And we have research coordinators that can do that. But the best thing would be to schedule an appointment.
I see also that IV infusions and injections are used.
I used to be able to classify MS medications into three groups: the injectables, the orals, and the infusions. And overall, the injectable medications were the least effective, and the infusions were the most effective. And now there's so much overlap. We have injectable medications that are extremely effective, and we even have some pills that are extremely effective. But overall, I would recommend just the most effective MS medication for one's disease, whichever one is the most appropriate. But we can no longer say the infusions are the most effective and everyone should be on an infusion medication, because the side effects and risk may not warrant that depending on one's disease.
It's more of a specialized thing. It's not one size fits all for every MS patient.
Okay. Exactly.
What about the future? Do you see MS being cured? Do you think we're coming closer to that?
I want to say yes, I'm extremely hopeful, but I am so hopeful that I kind of look at multiple sclerosis as hypertension. I don't know if cardiologists get that question, because people look at hypertensive medications as a cure almost, right?
Yeah. Yes.
But it's still a pill, but there's no cure for high blood pressure. But people don't ask that question because there's such amazing medications that treat the disease so effectively that they're able to control high blood pressure, right?
Yes.
And that's kind of how I look at multiple sclerosis now, that we have such amazing MS medications that when a new patient comes into my office, I can tell them that if we work together and we start treating the disease at the onset of symptoms, or even with that first or second relapse, we can prevent any new disease moving forward. And to me, that's pretty close to what I think of hypertension. In terms of the cure, if I can see a future where I can give a pill to a patient and it reverses all of the lesions or reverses any signs of the disease, I'm not sure I can promise that, but I know people are working for a vaccine for Epstein-Barr virus. So I'll get back to you in 20 years when everyone's vaccinated for Epstein-Barr to see if we can actually just eradicate MS altogether. But we're a long ways away from that. But I think if this disease should not, it used to make people scared to go see a neurologist because they didn't want to get the diagnosis because it was a wheelchair sentence. And it's not the case anymore. So I would encourage and recommend anybody that has a concern for this disease or has a suspicion or was told, you know, you might have multiple sclerosis, to not be fearful, because we do have amazing therapies that can stop the progression, that can stop new lesions from occurring.
It certainly seems like it's very different than even 5-10 years ago.
Extremely, extremely different. And it's one of the things that I tell my patients when they come in and meet me for the first time. I don't want to say this, but I still find myself saying this. Be careful what you read, because if it's even 3 years old, it'll make it seem like it's a wheelchair sentence, that you're going to end up debilitated. And that's not the case anymore. It's treated appropriately early on. The one thing that we don't have in this disease is something that reverses the damage that was done, something that repairs myelin or repairs the nervous system. So for those that have been diagnosed years ago that already have a lot of symptoms, I don't want people to give up hope because there's so much more in terms of research, in terms of physical therapy, occupational therapy, symptomatic medications that are available now that if you kind of stop seeing your doctor, you might want to revisit that again because there's a lot more things that are going on. The other thing is we often forget that the nervous system is part of a much global body and everything affects multiple sclerosis, cardiovascular disease, GI symptoms, urology. So a lot of people have urinary tract infections that go undetected because it's masked by the MS. So if there is something going on, it's worth to get it checked out because it may not be the multiple sclerosis. It may be something else. And it's important to stay positive and also work closely with our healthcare team to basically stay in tune. Like, I hate comparing bodies to cars, but we kind of forget that we need tune-ups once in a while, you know, and whether that is stress reduction techniques like yoga or acupuncture, which I'm a huge fan of, diet and nutrition. But there's a lot that goes into treating the disease, and it's not just about the medication that you're on anymore.